Welcome back to Classical Guitar Insider. This is your host, Brett Williams. And today on the show, we have guitarist and composer Laura Snowden. She's visiting us from England. She visited me on a Saturday, and unfortunately, I was not on my game. She was great. She's charming. I think you learned stuff about her. So I want to make sure this episode goes out, but I'm ashamed at how just off my game I was during this interview. Maybe I'm projecting. Maybe it's not that bad. I'm about to listen to it, as I edit it today. And I just had a lot on my mind. The kids had just come back from school. You know that I started that new show, if you've been listening. And that show is, in fact, out now. So I hate, kind of throwing this out there during poor Laura's show, her podcast. I already screwed up the interview. Now I'm promoting a completely different show on this show. But you guys are the first people to know that it is, in fact, released. It's out. And the only people that know that it's out, my friends don't know it, my family doesn't know it, you guys know it. I trust you guys. I figure that if you're listening to this, you can sort of handle my voice, without vomiting. And that's why. Thank you for listening. It's 7 years, and I wouldn't be doing this if you guys weren't listening. So I hope that you'll also listen to this other show. And I think it's educational. It's, what you're listening to is, as opposed to this show, you're listening to the first draft. There's very few edits. That show, you're listening to like the 100th draft that me and producer David Steinhardt have done. He is also the producer at Tone Bass. And you can go and you can check out Tone Bass's podcast. It's another classical guitar podcast. It's great. And I urge you to go check it out. But really, David and I want you to check out the Music History Podcast. It's the musichistorypodcast.com. If you Google the Music History Podcast, you won't find it because it has never been searched. The only people that know that it exists is you. And so I hope that you'll go over there as soon as you finish listening to this and see if you like it. I hope you review it on iTunes, download it. I was just talking to Simon at the Classical Guitar Corner podcast, and we were sort of trying to go over the way numbers are working these days. And if you don't download the show, it just doesn't pop up on their radar. And people are streaming things now, and I think that's great. But download the show. It shows that you are supporting it to the people who actually are paying us. With that being said, the people who are paying us are on the show today. I've got Lyle Brewer, am I right? No, Lorenzo Brewer, right? Lyle Brewer was on the show. He was a guitarist on the show. But Lorenzo Brewer is the founder of Encoda, who is our new sponsor. They've sponsored several shows. It seems like they're in it for the long haul. So I'm going to talk to him a little bit about his app and his product. And, I'll save you on that. We'll talk more about that in a second. And also, the show is also sponsored by the best and the oldest and the guy who I owe my life to, Richard Sage, folks. Richard Sage at savageclassical.com. That's S-A-V-A-G-E classical.com. You can go there and get the guitar of your dreams. All right. So that is what we're going to be doing today. But I'm super excited about the Music History Podcast, and I hope that you'll go to the musichistorypodcast.com, that you'll become, you can donate if you want. That's helpful because this show, the history one, is very expensive and time consuming to produce. It probably takes 100 times the amount of effort, focus, and time and money that it takes me to produce this. I have to pay some of the performers that are being presented on the show. I do. I have to do it out of pocket. And generally, they want a lot more than what I initially offer. So I have to talk them down, and that takes time. And then I look like an asshole sometimes. So there's all sorts of things that I've had to do. I've had to talk to a lawyer about stuff to figure out the citations and everything. It's been a complete mess, and it's taken a lot of time. And it's just something that I cannot do unless I'm getting paid to do it because it just takes that amount of time. And I've been doing it with my weekends for the last several months. And my you know, my playing is kind of suffering because I don't have enough time to play because I have to teach for the money and do these shows. So really, in order for really both of these shows to continue, I'm going to need some support. You can either support the Music History Podcast, which I would prefer because kind of keep it all in one place. you can go to that website, musichistorypodcast.com, to do that. But mainly what I want you to do is I just want you to listen, and hopefully you'll review us on iTunes because those first, you know, we need to kind of build up those stars. They matter, and it looks good. And so let's if you guys would help me out by, you know, reviewing and rating the show and listening to it on iTunes. It'll be on Spotify and all that stuff in a little bit. I just got to figure all that out. And also just kind of become friends with us on Instagram. It's the Music History Podcast. At the Music History Podcast, you can become friends with us there. There's also a Facebook page. I'm not too sure how that works. But, you know, you can always find me, Brett Williams, you know, at Facebook, and then you can work it out there. Anyways, I'm trying to actually do a big boy marketing thing with this instead of just putting it out there and hoping for the best like I generally do. I'm trying to do this in a real way. Anyway, thank you for your support. I hope you head over there to themusichistorypodcast.com. Please listen. I love you guys. It's only you. And then I'm going to start telling my friends and my family once you guys have made it look like someone cares. You know what I'm saying? Can you trick people into thinking that this show matters? Let's get on with it. Let's go to Lorenzo Brewer, not Lyle Brewer, their outstanding guitarist out there in Boston. Good guy. Lorenzo Brewer. Lorenzo Brewer and his Encoda. Okay, Lorenzo, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Brett.
Yeah, no problem. So this is actually a really cool website. It's something that I've always wanted, and we all kind of go online and look for sheet music, and we, you know, it has the sort of watermark going through it, and you only get the first page. But this is something that, you know, we don't have to go in and pay 10 or 15 or 20 or more dollars in order to get this sheet music. It's a subscription service, so that if we play this music on a regular basis, we'll be able to access it, you know, on the fly. Is that about right?
Yeah, I mean, I guess when we talk about Encoda shorthand, we say it's, you know, the Spotify or the Netflix of sheet music. It's about being able to have a subscription to access all of the stuff that you use to play, practice, or perform music, or of course in the context of your audience, particularly the guitar music that they want to play.
Right. So in this case, what I'm looking on, I'm on your page right now, and I'm seeing that it's available on all the devices. So that's really good for us too. I know a lot of musicians are using the iPads, and with the new iPad Pro being the, you know, 8.5 by 11 size, it's really handy. And I think, you know, you're kind of hitting this at the right time now that there's these tablets that are actually the size of real sheet music.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it's like all of these things, right? You have to be lucky enough to turn up at a time when what it is that you build is appropriate for the market. And I think one of the reasons why Encoda was founded was because you could see that technology was being used to perform music more and more, to practice it, to teach it. And we wanted to provide a legal space that was good for the kind of holistic music community to do that. And that was the kind of principle. It was about providing access to people through technology.
And that must have been quite the effort to sort of go through all the legal hoops to get access to all this and make sure that you were kind of making sure everybody was getting the credit that they were due and talking to all the publishers. And how did that all pan out?
Well, I mean, I think that one of the things that we have done, I hope, well, is that we built relationships with publishing partners that were positive. And by that, I mean, we said, how is it that we can facilitate your music to be used in new and interesting ways, and how is it that we can support that community? And so I think starting from an approach of how can we work together to make this a better space for people to make music in, meant that we ended up having, you know, a very collaborative, positive approach to the legal, to the licensing, and then to, of course, the distribution of the app as well.
And that's really important to people too, is that, you know, they're actually going through a legal source rather than, you know, downloading things illegally. I mean, that it means a lot to us, especially when we're talking about new music.
Yeah, and I think it's really important that we all recognize as musicians that we're part of an ecosystem, right? Yeah. And, you know, the reason why it's important for us to pay for things in an economic, affordable way, of course, is so that we can contribute back to that economic system, which is what, you know, people who are writing music, performing it, making it, stimulating that economy so everyone can be better paid, so there can be more new opportunities, more new music made.
Yeah, that's exciting, and that's also relatively unique. And as far as like what are some of the features that you're most excited about? I can see here that you can mark up your own music, which is pretty cool. That's something, you know, important to be able to do digitally.
I mean, I think for us, there are sort of the key things are the catalog. So we have sort of tens of thousands of pieces of music on the app. There's millions of pages. We have more than 100 publishing partners now. So the kind of centerpiece of the experience is saying to people, look, here's this access. But something really cool that we just launched recently is personalized curation. So when you first get into the Encoder app and you start your trial, we'll ask you some questions like, so what instruments do you play at what kind of level? And then we'll build this discover page area for you and personally curate it. So if you say, I play intermediate guitar, but I'm a beginner piano player and I sing, then we can every day, every week, be giving you new things to look at, to improve your learning, to improve your playing. And then, of course, as you say, it's all the experience in the scores, being able to annotate with digital tools, being able to share those annotations, being able to store all your music into a library, which is just like your Apple Music or your Spotify, in a kind of single space. And then making that not just something which is for you, but something which you can, you know, share with the world. So creating playlists of music, which then you can link to other people, or, you know, sharing individual pieces or guitar methods. And, you know, just like you have with other streaming services, you have a link, you can put it anywhere in your WhatsApp group, in your Facebook, on your iMessage, and then someone can click and they can open it in their own Encoder account. So those are the kind of cool things, you know, the catalog, the personalization, the tools, and then the building of a library, which you can share with the world.
Yeah, the collaboration effort is really going to be... That's really going to be appreciated by the ensembles. Well, thanks so much, Lorenzo. I really believe in it, and I'm really proud that you're supporting the show. And
we're proud to support you, bro. Thank you.
All right. So make sure that you do go to encoda.com. That's NKODA.com for more information about that. Thank you very much for coming on the show, Lorenzo, and also Thomas, who's helped us set everything up between me and that company. And also make sure you visit Richard Sage at SavageClassical.com, and always visit BrettWilliamsMusic.com to become a member or to donate to the show. And please, for the love of God, go to TheMusicHistoryPodcast.com. Let's get on with the show. I'm sorry for all the plugs, but it's just one of those days, folks. And you can listen to me stumble through this interview with the wonderful Laura Snowden.
My voice.
Really?
Yeah, I used to record songs on a tape player. So, like, I used to make up songs and then record the vocal parts and the words on my tape player. And then my dad would work out the chords. Kind of cute.
Oh, so your dad played guitar?
Yeah.
And did he teach you guitar? Was he your first?
No.
First teacher?
No, I had my teacher at my primary school. But, yeah, he just used to work out the chords for my songs. So it was kind of cute.
That is cute. That's a good father-daughter relationship situation.
Yeah.
What was his overall, what did he do? What was his job?
A French teacher.
A French teacher.
Yeah.
And you told me earlier that you're half French.
Yeah, yeah. My mother's French, yeah.
Is she French? Like, has an accent, the whole thing?
Yep. That kind of French.
That kind of French. You got the best of both worlds.
Yeah.
Yeah. Who was your dad more the musician in the family?
Yeah, I mean, when I was little, he was playing the Irish tenor banjo, which is kind of not the sort of thing you want to be hearing when you're a little child somehow. But then later I developed this kind of nostalgia about folk music, and then I created a folk band because of that. But at the time, I was like, what is this?
And you're saying it's a Scottish tenor banjo?
Irish tenor banjo,
Tenor banjo.
Yeah, yeah. But then he was kind of playing back to guitar again, and now he's into jazz guitar. So he's gone through various phases.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, so he's doing jazz guitar.
Yeah.
He's taking lessons or what?
No, he's self-taught, but he's really good. I don't think he knows how good he is, but he's really good.
So then the mom didn't play anything. The dad was the guitarist, but you started studying classical guitar at what age? Because you're very good.
I started studying at the age of 9 in my primary school. So we had a... You'd call that elementary school here, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, there was a classical guitar teacher there. So I started with her.
Oh, so you still keep in touch with her?
No.
What was her name?
She was called Mrs. Clifford.
Mrs. Clifford.
And she had a poodle, but I'm scared of dogs. So the poodle would sit on the back of your chair while you were having your lesson as like a little cute thing, but I was scared of dogs, so she used to remove the poodle for my lessons.
Those can be kind of scary dogs too. They can be kind of, they can have violence in their eyes.
I mean, yeah, I was always very scared of dogs at that age, so.
What made you, do you have an anecdote for why you're scared of dogs?
Well, in, I think year three, Mrs. Cattle told us that once a dog had bitten a chunk out of her bottom and then she had to get it sewn back on. So that may have had something to do with it. Yeah, possibly.
Yeah, that'll do it. An adult tells you that they had their ass chewed by a dog.
Yeah.
You're like, I don't want to get near that. No. That sounds terrifying.
I don't know why she told us that.
They are terrifying animals. They do bark a lot.
Yeah.
And people are always surprised and say this never happens when they bark.
Yeah, that's true.
What's that like in the UK? What's the dog etiquette over there as compared to here? Here it's pretty, I think it's abysmal. People just let their dogs walk around without leashes sometimes, stuff like that. What would happen in London?
In London, the dogs do what they want, but they're very used to people. So I don't, I think that I have never felt we were very scared of the dogs in London because...
But country dogs?
Yeah, I don't know about those.
Shire dogs or whatever.
Yeah, I don't know. That teacher also told us that we were going to go to Egypt. She started in Mrs. Cattle.
Mrs. Cattle, the classical guitar teacher.
Oh, no, this is not the guitar teacher. Oh, this is just the one who told us that she got the chunk bitten out of her bottom.
Divulging far too much information.
She said we were going to Egypt at the beginning of the year, but we never went to Egypt. I think she meant it sort of metaphorically. Like, we're going to go to Egypt this year.
But you're a third grader, and you're like,
and I was like, oh, we're going to Egypt! But no.
No, you didn't.
No.
Have you been to Egypt?
No.
No, you're relatively close. You could just go there, I feel like.
Yeah, I suppose so.
But, you know.
Too late now.
Too much stuff to do.
Yeah.
Too late now. What do you call bangs again? Just one more time?
Fringe.
Okay, I'll remember that because I'll listen to this and then I'll write it down. So as far as Egypt is concerned, you've never been to Egypt, but where have you been as far as college and stuff like that? It's university. Who'd you study with? All that stuff.
Yeah. I went to the Yehudi Menuhin School from the age of 16 to 19, which is a specialist.
New Dominion.
The Yehudi Menuhin School. It's a specialist school in the UK.
Yeah, the violin.
Yeah. So it was founded by him. And I went there on a scholarship, which most people who go there are on very heavy scholarships. It's like a very heavily funded school.
Yes.
And I went there for 3 years. That was actually, the program there was started because of the Rolling Stones. The guitar program. So the Rolling Stones gave a donation to the school and that allowed the school to start the guitar.
Wow. So before that, there was nothing?
No, there was no guitar. I think it started in 2004.
Oh, so it's a brand new school?
No, the guitar program, I mean.
In that sense?
Yeah.
I mean, as far as a brand new studio?
Yeah.
And who's the teacher there?
Richard Wright. And then I studied with him at the Royal College of Music. And then I had a year out. Just to kind of like work out, you know, when you've just been going with education and you're a bit like, what am I doing?
Yeah.
So I just wanted to just work and just see, kind of recalibrate and think, what am I doing education for? And just take some time out of that and just keep plowing on. And then I went back for postgrad. I had lessons with Gary Ryan and Carlos Bunnell. And then I also met Julian Bream that way because of the scholarship, and so I ended up then having lessons with him for about 4 years as well.
Yeah, I want to get to that because that's sort of a rare situation, being able to get in with Julie Breen these days. But as far as your time out that you took to recalibrate and to decide why you were doing this, that's an interesting question. It's a question a lot of listeners are constantly asking themselves, is why they're doing this. A lot of these people are, you know, in college now and stuff like that.
Mm.
What was your justification for continuing on this, you know, long and arduous journey? At that point, like, it seems like you obviously decided to go on with it. So what?
Yeah, I mean, it was more just to try and work out which aspects of it I wanted to do more and what I was most interested in. So I
rather than letting them just drive you from
I wanted to do a lot more composing, a lot more creative stuff, more performing. And also, I think I just had this sort of realization, like, I don't think I'd actually want to go to my own concert. You know, like,
could
very easily be just doing things, just, I don't know. And I remember going to Pavel Steidl's concert and and or Derek Gripper, and just being so moved, and the whole package, like the whole way it was presented, just everything about it, just so holistic and heartfelt and honest. And so I remember writing down a list of all the things that were important to me, like generosity, creativity, connection, communication, drama, narrative, and just being like, you have to try and abide by these in everything that you do from now on. So I just really tried to make a commitment to do the things that were actually important to me.
That's amazing. I think that everybody should have to do that after this, after graduating, after getting the skills to play the thing. Now what are you going to do with it, right? And your realization that you wouldn't go to your own concert, what were you playing back then? Were you only playing other people's music? You were playing straight recital repertoire?
Yeah. And I mean, it's very hard. It's a bit of a superficial thing to say, because in a way, you can't say whether you'd go to your own concert, because you can't really see yourself, you know, neutrally, because you're inside yourself. So who knows? Maybe I would have gone to my own concert, but it was more just I felt that I was a little bit trying to be a good musician, or trying to do the right thing, or something like that. Just in some kind of subtle things of how I felt about it inside myself. And I'd always been this kind of fiercely creative and imaginative person, and I just wanted to connect with that side of myself more.
Yeah, this world doesn't necessarily reward people for that all the time.
Yeah, not necessarily, yeah.
Yeah, they don't. I mean, they generally kind of want you to do your own, or to get in line a little bit and start playing the rep and play it better than everybody else. Mm-hmm. And as far as your composition, was that something you took a break from for a while? And then
not hugely, but I had a bit of
a... It's very difficult to do it when you're in college. Yeah,
and also I did study it in college. I did it as a second study.
That's great.
Yeah, that was good. But I had a bit of a complex about the idea of playing my own pieces. So I would write for other people. I wrote a guitar and violin piece for someone else. I wrote like a harpsichord piece, string orchestra. I wrote for lots of different instruments. I didn't really write much for guitar. But I had a bit of a complex about playing my own pieces, because people would say things like, oh, everyone's a guitarist composer nowadays. Mm-hmm. Or be very dismissive about the idea of the guitarist composer.
I wonder why they are that way, or why they feel that way.
I don't know. I mean, I guess there's a bit of a thing about... There has been a trend at some points to be so specialist that it's considered that you can't possibly be really a specialist in composition and also a specialist in interpretation, a bit like you have to pick and you have to be specialist in one thing.
Yeah.
People sometimes think that. And also maybe they've heard pieces that they just didn't like, or they've had bad experiences with composer guitarists. But I mean, on the other hand, I don't even care, because I just feel like if someone wants to do that, they should. And like, why should people be pressured to make this kind of highest art possible or whatever? Like, there's something just really beautiful in just writing a bit of music yourself. I remember Phil Houghton. Do you know Phil Houghton?
The Australian guy?
Yeah. So we had a really amazing kind of email correspondence for a couple of years before he passed away. It was really beautiful. Yeah. It kind of changed my whole approach to composition. And
was that just you met him in a masterclass?
We met at Shakespeare's Globe in London, because my band was playing there in a series organized by John Williams. Uh-huh. And then he'd been flown over there by John Williams to listen to a performance of one of his pieces in one of the other concerts in the series. And we kind of hit it off. And then, yeah, he would send me these amazingly inspiring emails. It was really incredible.
Like, he liked your music a lot.
Yeah. And we just had some kind of... He was on this completely other level, I think, just on this sort of spiritual... magical kind of plane of thought.
Yeah.
But I remember him saying to me, because I think
pieces are very whimsical.
Yeah, and very, they're very much inspired by other things like colors, visual stuff, and that's sort of how I think as well. And I'd always been a bit embarrassed by the fact that I thought like that, because I thought it meant I wasn't musical enough. So I was really inspired by this. But anyway, he'd written to me, because I'd been saying that someone had said, like, this music is not Laura enough or something. And he was like, how does this person know what's Laura and what will always be Laura and what always has been Laura? And he said he felt there was too much pressure on people sometimes to find their own voice. And he was like, just writing a C major chord could be beautiful. So thus, and that was the point I was getting to about people just writing something. It doesn't have to be the best thing in the world, but like he said, just writing a chord could be a beautiful experience.
Well, also people need to understand that your musical personality or your artistic personality is very different from your social personality. You know, so in other words, like he's saying, you just write a C chord. Well, some of the stuff you might write might be very beautiful, and you might have sort of a more harsh edge to the way you deal with people in public. You know what I mean? At least that's the case with me. Because I'm also a guitarist composer.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, along those lines, you had said something. We're embarrassed about the fact that you wanted to write in a more colorful language as opposed to what, a more academic language? Or where did you feel?
It's sort of the fact that I've always been interested kind of in all different art forms.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, when I was younger, I was far more interested in theatre, creative writing, visual art than I ever was in music.
Did you act?
Yeah, I was really bad, but I wanted to be an actor. That was actually my goal, but I was just so bad.
You were just so bad?
Yeah.
How do you know when you were bad? Did your parents tell you you were bad?
Kind of.
Was it your French mother who told you you were bad?
No, no.
It was your English dad.
No, I don't know if either of them really said I was bad.
Well,
but
the French people seem to tell me when I'm bad all the time.
Oh, so really? Okay. No. I mean, it was more through experience that I realized that I was bad because I wasn't getting many parts. You know, The Lord of the Flies. So we did a...
You were a kid then when you did that.
Yeah, but the thing was, it was in my school. I auditioned, and I was really tall, like I am now. But I was given the part of the little un. You know, the little uns are basically the little kids who run around and don't do anything.
And then the older ones. I mean, I haven't read the book.
I mean, basically, the little uns just don't do anything.
You pass the conch.
Yeah,
you gotta talk. Can't talk without the conch.
Yeah, yeah. Right. The little uns. I mean, they're just like in the background, they didn't do anything, so I just had to run around the stage the whole time following the action. I never got to say anything or do anything.
That's when you realized it.
Yeah, that's when I realized.
You're like, there's like seven other kids that are talking.
Yeah.
And I don't get to talk.
Yeah.
How old were you when that happened?
13, I think, 14, maybe 15. I don't quite remember.
Right.
Something
so
around that.
You've always been involved in the stage.
Yeah.
But you you didn't, yeah, you just knew at that point.
Yeah.
It's not going to happen.
Yeah, not good, yeah. So, but I'd always had this kind of general imaginative kind of creative approach to things.
And you
general.
Wanted a dramatic presence.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And also like a lot of creativity. Like when I was younger, I'd spent so much time with my grandmother, my English grandmother, and we used to like read poems together. We used to go to the beach and then pick dragon's eggs. So the dragon's eggs were like pebbles, and then we'd go home and see if the dragon's eggs hatched. Stuff like that. It was very imaginative. So
your grandma would do that with you?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, really kind of creative and imaginative.
Constantly.
Early years. Yeah, yeah. So I always kind of had that. And then, so for me, say with music or with writing a piece of music, I would always associate it really strongly with images and words and other things. But then I felt that that was not musical enough because if you're a good musician, the music alone should be enough.
Right. So you needed to have it. You were sort of going in that, you were saying Philip Houghton idea of associative relationships between the music, the notes.
Yeah.
And ideas.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. Yeah, no, we do kind of shy. At least I kind of feel like a pressure to shy away from that. You know. Even when I title a piece, I'm kind of like, I don't want to.
Yeah,
can't be too
exactly.
on the nose.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
So your compositional style, like what do you, unfortunately, just because I'm kind of in the middle of a lot of things right now, as I was talking to you, I didn't get a chance to review too much of your work. I saw a couple of videos on YouTube, but I wasn't too aware of the fact that you were composing.
Oh, okay.
But what? Tell me more about your compositional style. Like what do you, it sounds like you're tonal, for starters. Or are you somewhere in between?
I don't know. I mean, it's usually a bit kind of modal, multimodal.
Right.
But
lots of modulation or
not really. Sometimes I really don't do modulation at all. I just have a piece consisting of about seven notes. But,
wow. So it's meditative, it's repetitive.
Yeah, often meditative. Okay. It depends, you know, I've tried different things and I'm trying to each time I write something kind of start afresh and be quite open to maybe this is going to be completely different from the previous piece. But I've been incorporating the voice in some pieces. So I do these kind of pitch bends and slides that blend with the harmonics. Mm-hmm. I'm writing pieces at the moment where I'm talking and singing as well. Some things are very lively and kind of folk influenced, but a lot is very meditative and about trying to find a kind of stillness.
Right. And so that's what you're focusing on that at this point? You have some training too.
Yeah.
So go ahead.
I was just going to say the most recent piece I wrote was about spiders.
Okay. Mm. And that is very...
that is very specific.
That's associative.
Yes,
does it sound like a spider?
Yes, I think so. I was looking out of my window. It's not my fault. It's because there's half of our window. Half of our window doesn't open. So all of these spiders have made their spiders webs there, and there's like 12 spiders living there. So when I'm composing, I can't. I'm just looking at
there's
the spiders.
There's spiders everywhere.
Yeah, there's nothing I can do about it.
You could get rid of the spiders.
No, I can't because the window doesn't open. So they're stuck.
Okay, let me picture this now. So the window is not opening.
Yes.
But in between the window and the screen is this spider world.
Which screen?
Well, I don't know. It sounds like the spiders are caught between something and something.
Oh, no, they're just outside the window.
Ah.
But I can't open the window.
Yeah, okay.
So then you can't get rid of them.
You have no access to
spider
land.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So they're just more and more and more of them. And
I don't like
plus
that.
They have beautiful
they're beautiful.
They're very beautiful and their web's beautiful. And I was thinking of naming them.
Because you have can you tell the difference?
I can, I'm gradually learning to, yeah.
What are you gonna name them? You have any ideas?
I don't know. Harriet, I think, for one of them.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
Harriet's a spidery name.
Yeah. Michael Miller.
Michael Miller and Harriet.
Yeah.
All right, so we got two.
Yeah.
How many spiders are there in total?
Approximately 12.
That's way too many spiders to be staring at.
Yes.
They're getting in your brain.
Yeah, well, that's why the piece was about spiders. If I move house or something, all the pieces are going to be completely different. Because now there's a big window and you see the sky really big. So the pieces have been quite sky-like.
Yeah,
recently.
Right. But now you're getting grounded. The spiders are pulling you back in.
Yeah.
What'd you learn at? What were some of the lessons that you learned when you were in composition school? A lot of guitarists like me didn't do that. We did the guitar thing and then we just started writing off the top of our head.
Mm.
I found it really difficult to write for other instruments, which I did.
Mm.
Especially the clarinet and stuff like that. I was just writing sort of quick passages and he was like, I would have to play all of this with my pinky finger.
Okay, right.
You know,
yeah.
Little things like that. But as far as, what's your process?
I don't think that's anything I specifically learned from composition lessons. In the lessons, I think I learned more techniques
work?
For what to do with the material. I remember looking at Bartok Microcosmos mm-hmm. and sort of trying to analyze what Bartok did with a very small piece of material in each piece. And then I had to try and write my own piece using my own material, but using the same techniques to develop the material as he did. So it was more tools for developing stuff.
Oh, wow. Okay, so you brought in a piece, and then he said, let's try and adapt this to Bartok's microcosmos style.
Not exactly. It was, I'd analyzed...
Or was that the assignment?
It was kind of the other way around, so I'd analyze the Bartok piece first without having written anything, and then we'd look at, okay, what was happening in that piece, and then, okay, now try and write your own little piece where you do the same techniques.
Use the same system.
Yeah.
And what was that system did you find?
Well, it would
be
different
things. It was
an axial
system with him, right?
So, well, it would be... It was more looking at how he... For example, he starts with a small cell, and then he inverts it, and then that melody then goes into the bass with something else on top, and then they swap around, or something like that. So it would be different for each one. And it wasn't so much... We weren't looking at, like, the harmonic language so much as more structural devices.
You were looking at the treatment of the motives.
Yeah,
whatever
exactly,
you want to call
exactly, yeah. So... And then I do that kind of in my own language, but try and do the same stuff to it. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that seems like that's not so much meditative. So you do have sort of the history of writing in various styles.
I would have probably still done it kind of in my own style, so my own kind of language,
right.
But just trying to apply the same techniques of how to develop an idea.
You're talking about your band at the Globe. What's what's the instrumentation for that?
So that was me on guitar and sometimes voice, a viola player and voice, then voice and flute and also tin whistle, baron, which is this Irish drum, and then electric bass.
Like this one?
The stick like right. that. And sometimes he would play other percussion instruments as well.
An electric bass. Mm. And you say, it sounds like this was your band.
Yeah, yeah.
So they were your songs.
I mean, it was a joint. We were all equally kind of part of it, but it was quite a lot of my songs. I think we recorded an album, I think that had 6 of my songs on it.
Where'd you meet all these people?
College.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that was because we met really strangely. So during my first year at college, I was kind of sad. And then I did this Say Yes to Everything week, which sounds like the kind of thing that Amy Schumer would write a movie about. But it was, I actually did it. It was real. And during that week, I started my first teaching job. And then also I responded to this advert on the college bulletin about, anyone want to play some folk music? Go busking, see where it takes us. So I just went to this meeting, with this guy, Rory Glasheen, who was the percussionist and a violinist. And then we started busking. Do you call it busking here?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
I don't know why it's called busking, but we do.
Yeah, yeah. So we did some really odd gigs in the early years. We did one where they said that Rory wasn't allowed to play the drum because they didn't have a drum license.
Oh, there's a drum license.
Yes. So he asked, can I play the walls? And they were like, yeah. Can I play the floor? Yeah. Can I play this box of food? Yeah. So he just hit everything as hard as he possibly could in the gig. But he wasn't allowed to play like this tiny, quiet, handheld Irish drum because it was so silly. So, but then we, after a while, we got going and did much more cool things. But yeah, in the beginning, it was really fun though. And we did a lot of busking and just like a lot of silliness, playing on the tube.
When you did the composition, though, you could have gone that direction. What drove you in keeping yourself a guitar major? What was that decision like when you were in college?
What drew you
to the instrument?
Initially, I think I was drawn to it as a child just because I found it very soothing.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
And I always had a lot of headaches. And
wow.
I think maybe it just made me feel a bit calmer. And I just really liked the sound. I kind of like the feeling of playing it. And you're kind of cradling it. It's just nice.
It is nice, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, we don't think about that enough because it just becomes so much of a job.
Sometimes I kiss my guitar and I say, thank you.
You do?
When I'm in a good mood. Sometimes I want to throw it out the window.
Yeah, sometimes you never want to see it again.
Yeah, sometimes I think, maybe I'll just smash it up after a gig. But then I don't.
No, you never do.
No, because I do love that guitar.
Yeah. What kind of guitar are you playing?
It's made by Christopher Dean, who is a guitar maker from the UK. He lives near Oxford. It's such a beautiful guitar. It's kind of blossomed since I got it. I've had it for about 13 years now.
What kind of wood is it on the face of the guitar?
Spruce.
Spruce, there you go. That's a decision.
Yeah. Right?
Spruce is sort of the direction we're going. You sure you don't want any coffee?
No, I've had some. I'm okay, thank you.
Yeah. What'd you do this morning for coffee? Where would you go?
A place next to where I was.
There you go.
You know, the place where I was, the air was singing all night.
The air was?
Yeah.
What do you mean?
Well, I think it's a wind chime.
Oh.
But it kind of sounded like a mixture between the Harry Potter theme tune and, you know, that ringtone that goes down, down, da, 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 down, down, down.
Yes, I know that.
That wasn't well sung, sorry. Down, down, da, 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 down, 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 down. So it's like that, but then it's also a bit like Harry Potter. Down, da, da, down, down, down.
But it was just constant all
night.
Yeah.
I think it's a wind chime, but it hasn't been the other days. Was it more windy than usual yesterday?
I don't know. We can check.
I think that would be a worthwhile use of our time.
We'll check later. We'll figure this out for sure. But I'm going to assume that if the wind... First of all, I want wind chimes.
Okay.
But
why?
I don't want to hear them all.
No.
I want them right there. That's my room. I want them right in the window.
Mm.
But if I have to turn the air conditioner on, it's like... It's just it's a disaster. I had wind chimes. I love them. I love the sound of them. Yeah. Do you live in like what part of London do you live in?
It's south.
I was just there. I was there in April. I love it.
Oh, cool. Yeah. Yeah, like Southwest is where I live.
The Southwest?
Hmm.
Okay, so you're not in the East.
No, I'm not in the cool part.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's where I live. Yeah, in a flat.
That's not in Chelsea or Soho and stuff like that. That's more central, right?
Yeah, that's more central, yeah.
Oh, so you're further over
yeah.
than that.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Are there like colleges over there and stuff like that?
Not music colleges, no. I think there's some universities in the
what
area.
What made you decide on that neighborhood?
Just because it's sort of practical in terms of where I need to be for example, the menu in school where I teach now. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of fairly easy to get there. And there's parks and things nearby.
Oh, you're teaching
nearby.
At the school that
yeah.
you went to?
Yeah.
Are you the professor there?
I'm assistant guitar teacher.
Wow, how's that going?
Good. Yeah. I've been there for about 5 years now, I think.
And you got a nice little group of students that you can sort of depend on for work and stuff like that?
I mean, it's only a part of it because it's only a few hours a week because we have quite a small class.
Yeah.
Because the school itself only has about 80 students.
Oh, so, the whole school?
Yes, yeah.
Are most of them violinists and pianists?
Yeah, and cellists as well. So, and double bass, some double bassists. So the guitarists, wow. I think the most we've ever had is seven.
Seven people between the two of you?
Yeah, well, I mean, so the main teacher sees them twice, then I see them once a week. So they get three lessons a week, which is quite a lot.
That is.
Yeah.
They get three lessons
yeah,
a week.
Yeah.
That is quite a lot. Why are you doing that? I think it's good, I guess.
I think the idea was...
Definitely
two
keep you on
lessons.
Your toes.
Yeah, two lessons a week. And then the assistant role, I guess, is to kind of help them with the stuff that they're doing.
Right.
You know,
sit there and be like, have you done this?
I mean, I take a more active role, to be honest, because I want to be as helpful as I can. So I'm not just seeing it as a practice assistant. But
what's your role there? I mean, yeah, because you have a... What's your role there as far as... What did you determine your role to be with your students? You're saying it's more a practice. You're helping them practice. You're helping them.
I think it's a teaching role, but it's that I won't be deciding repertoire or things like that. So the main teacher will decide that. But then I'm teaching. You know, I'm teaching like I would teach any lesson.
Right. You're like, don't do this. Do this.
Not in those words, but that kind of idea.
Well, I think that one of the ways that we can be more successful is in the schools as teachers, not only just financially, it would make us be able to do it for a living, would be to, maybe have some daily sort of treat more as a coaching situation rather than, get sharer of information.
Yeah.
Sure, you share the information, especially because I teach, I'm still sort of relegated to and have resigned myself to children.
Mm-hmm.
So I teach kids. And one of the things that I try to share with the parents is I'm like, well, sometimes I'm going to give them new information.
Hmm.
Sometimes I'm just going to be there and I'm going to coach them through it like a personal trainer would.
Yeah, exactly.
I think that's a healthy and very justifiable way for them to spend their money and time.
Yeah,
and
definitely.
For me to spend mine.
Yeah, I think as well because I perform a lot. So whereas the main teacher doesn't perform so much. So I guess I see my role as more almost like a bit to do with performance skills and performance psychology. So I guess we have kind of different areas of expertise. And I spend more time these days looking at the body and how the body sort of might ideally function to help with classical guitar playing. So that's sort of an interest of mine that I'm growing at the moment.
Yeah, well, it sounds like it. I'd like to talk about that. Also, do you have performance anxiety that you work through? Is that what you work through with your students? You're like, these are the tools, these are the things that you can do in these situations?
I mean, I don't know if I'd call it performance anxiety, but, you know, the normal things where you're... I just think it can be helpful to speak to somebody who also performs and who understands the demands and how difficult and strenuous
stressful.
That can be, on many levels.
And how do you do with that? I mean, if you don't mind sharing, if you don't feel like you're giving away too much, what do you do as far as, what is your body curriculum sort of encompass? What are you doing with that?
Well, I've been sort of influenced by the Alexander technique a lot because I studied that.
Yeah.
at college, and there was these two amazing teachers, Judith Kleinman and Peter Buckoak, who were just unbelievable and really kind of changed my life. So, of course, you know, I'm not teaching the Alexander Technique. That's not something I've studied in that depth to be able to teach it, but I'm drawing on some of the things that I've learned from that.
What are some of those things? I'm a little, I mean, I sat through one lecture and then that was it. And I was sort of young and sort of dismissive of the whole idea.
Oh, okay.
But I think now, you know, having been through all these performances and all this life, I feel like coming back to it would be pretty beneficial.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
What are sort of the key aspects of it that you put into your own teaching technique?
A lot of it is to do with, I suppose, tuning into certain parts of the body more, so you're not just only thinking about the fingers, but, for example, about the sit bones or the jaw, or it's a lot about the neck-head relationship and the idea that when that's kind of in balance, then the rest of the body's coordination might take place more easily. But then there's also Tamani, which is a method from Norway, part of the Institute of Health and Musicians' Health and Wellbeing, I think it's called now. Mm. And that's about kind of which muscles might ideally be engaged in performance and which ones might be relaxed, and gives you kind of specific exercises, almost a bit like physio, that are designed to try and help that take place. So, I mean, I find all of this stuff really fascinating. It's sort of an area that I want to get into more and more.
Do you find it not only fascinating, do you find it helpful?
Like, totally, yeah. I mean, I feel that all of that stuff has contributed to at least sort of half of any improvements that I've ever made at playing the guitar, because I don't think I'm naturally that well coordinated. I'm not very strong. I don't think I'm naturally
supposed to be playing guitar.
Yeah, exactly. So it's in it's this thing of, however, you know, musical or imaginative you might be, sometimes your fingers just don't want to do the thing that you want them to do. And then what are you supposed to do? Just practice it over and over and over again? Like, if your body just won't do it.
Yeah, what do we do?
Yeah, so that's really what I'm interested in. And I think a lot of things that are sometimes attributed to a musical problem, like, this is not legato enough, as if you're not musical enough to hear it. Often people can hear it, they know, but it's just that their fingers won't do it.
Yeah.
So I'm so fascinated by all of that. And I think a lot of almost trauma can take place from people having to go on stage and do this thing with their body in front of people with a body that's not functioning as they want it to be. And things are going wrong and they don't want that to be happening, you know. So it's like really intense and traumatic. And
it sure is.
Yeah. So that's why I'm really interested in looking at it and like, why are those things and what really makes a difference? I mean, it's going to be different for everybody. So it's also easy to think that that will help everyone and we're all different. But for me, that's been really profound, and for many of my colleagues, I think.
But as far as your colleagues are concerned, I mean, that's the thing, is because you look at some of these colleagues and it's just effortless.
Yeah.
And I'm just sitting here and I'm going, I can't help but feeling like I'm spending 2 months on this passage that this guy got through in 25 minutes.
I mean,
so is that what gives?
Yeah, for me, I often think that that is partly, certainly, down to use, which is what they call in Alexander Technique, basically the way you use your body and the way it's functioning, kind of on a mechanical level, almost like which bits of yourself you're using and which you're not, and where. That I think some people have somehow managed to keep a more natural, effortless coordination. That's, and then some people kind of lose it,
right?
Or yeah, they maybe they lose it very early or throughout their lives. So yeah, I feel like that's a big part of so-called talent,
right?
For sure.
Yeah, just the ability to hold on to that through all these other sort of influences that are occurring throughout the process of becoming a guitarist. Well, as far as, you know, I think we're kind of coming to the end here, but is there anything else that you wanted to cover before? Like, what else are you working on? What are your various ensembles?
I've got a my best friend Jiyeon Seo, who's a Korean violinist. Well, she's British Korean violinist. We're in a duo together, so she's also a composer, a really amazing composer. So we both write music for ourselves as well.
Oh, good.
Yeah, that's cool. But I mean, these days I'm...
See, I don't think everybody's writing music for themselves. I don't know. I mean, are you getting a lot of that pushback? Because I don't see that happening at all over here. It's like everybody's just playing other people's music.
Okay, yeah. I don't know. I'm seeing it quite a lot in London with various people.
That's great.
Yeah, yeah. Or people who were composers and also play an instrument and, you know, sing or something. But these days I'm trying to do a lot more composing. I've got a lot of pieces in my head that I want to get out, and more using the voice as well.
Yeah, that's interesting, using the voice. Did you get vocal training at all?
No, I mean, I've had a couple of lessons now, singing lessons and Timani lessons to do with singing, but, you know, like a handful of them. So it's not something I've studied, but it's something I really, really enjoy. I enjoy it in a disproportionate level to how good I am.
Did you always like singing a lot?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
You did? See, I didn't, and now I'm starting to do it more. Just singing. In front of people.
Yeah.
Yeah, I never would do it.
Yeah, yeah. I remember with the band, the first time, because I hadn't sung on my own or in public for such a long time, and the first time we were doing even harmonies, it was like so embarrassing.
Just pushing it out of you.
We were just, this is horrifying, and we were so out of tune. We're like, what's wrong with us? And
you're out of tune?
Yeah, I mean, of course. We're in practice, of course, right. Of course. And then we had to practice, and then. We were always asking Pip, the singer, like, how do we do it? How do we make it good? But then I remember the first time singing a song by myself, because I would sing this one particular folk song on my own, but also some of my own songs. And then I'd be so nervous. So that was quite a big thing to overcome. So I think there is something like a kind of block about singing almost that you can get. And it just feels so scary to do it.
It's terrifying.
Yeah.
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 It is. It's even hard to do it in front of just like I do it in front of the kids, and even then I'm very aware. I'm like, I'm singing.
Yeah, now. Exactly. Yeah. You know? Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty scary. Yeah. So you have the program that you're working on with your fellow composer who is a violinist, and that's pretty cool. Are you guys going to make a recording or?
I don't know. Maybe.
Maybe. Are you still with your band?
Not really, no. I mean, it's not like we've broken up or anything. Yeah. So, it's sort of in theory, if we really wanted to do something, we would. But
yeah,
two of them are living in Liverpool now. Mm. So, that's
pretty far
away. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's like really far, like 5 hours, 6 hours away.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. And also, we were just also busy with other projects. And it was, everyone was bored of doing the same songs, but it was a bit like, who's going to write some more songs? Nobody.
You. Yeah, you're supposed to be doing
well, yeah, I mean, all of us really, but we just, I was very busy with commissions and other compositions, so yeah, we kind of stopped doing it a bit.
Who was commissioning you?
So Vida Guitar Quartet, who's a quartet in the UK, yeah. Matt Wadsworth, the oboe player.
Wow.
I just recently, the Spider piece was for the London guitar competition. So it's their set piece for the semi-final. And now I'm writing another commission, so also for solo guitar.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Well, congratulations on all that and on your performance.
Thank you.
Last night, was this your first time in the US?
No. I had my debut in April, but this time I've been here since the 18th of September, so this is actually the longest I've been away.
You okay? What do you mean? I don't understand. You had your debut in April.
Yeah, then I went home. Then I came back.
Yeah, sure.
And then I came back on the 18th of September.
Right.
So this period of time, because I've been here for 3 weeks now, pretty much.
Oh yeah.
So
yeah.
That's been a long time for me to be.
You've been here for 3 weeks.
Yeah, nearly. Yeah.
Oh okay.
In the U.S., I was in Florida, then Chicago.
Oh, in U.S., right?
Other places.
Doing a little tour.
Yeah.
That's great. Did you have fun?
Yeah, yeah.
Do you like it here, or what do you think?
So I found people terrifyingly friendly.
Okay. Yeah.
In Chicago, especially.
Terrifying. Like, yeah.
They were so friendly.
Yeah.
You know, it's not what I'm used to, because in the UK, it's like if you look someone in the eye, it's considered too much.
Yeah.
So it's like I was asking somebody at the train station where I need to go, and like, oh, sure, ma'am. Well, you just need to take a left and then go here, and being so friendly to me. And then this guy came up to me and was like,
are you your playing? Accent probably sells them too. They're like, oh my god,
yeah,
guys.
Yeah, exactly. And this guy came up to me and was like, are you playing Fernando Sor in your concert? Just out of the blue. I mean, it was amazing. All these people talking to you. So
it's a little overwhelming.
Yeah, yeah, but it was nice. It's just I'm not used to such friendliness.
Oh, I like the London way. I like the whole English way. I always say I'm sorry to people.
Ah, okay,
all the time.
Yeah.
And they're always like, stop with the sorry.
Mm.
I went to England. Everybody said, sorry. So I was like, yeah, this is great. Everybody's so sorry. Just like me.
Yeah.
Just constantly like minimizing and apologizing myself.
Exactly. Sorry for my existence. Sorry that I'm on this tube. Yeah.
Right. But at the same time, just, you know, you can be as big of a dick as you are on the inside. If you say you're sorry, you just create, and oh, the tube's so quiet too. When I was just talking to you, I was complaining about the drummers.
Yeah.
In the subway.
Yeah.
And then you're in the tube and it's so quiet. Everybody's so quiet.
Yeah, but some of the lines are really noisy.
The what?
The lines themselves.
You mean the actual... Yeah, it is noisy. Mm. Yeah. I guess if you guys talked a little bit, you would be able to ignore that. Well, anyway, it's good to meet you.
You too.
Thank you for coming out.
Thanks for having
What are your plans for the rest of the day? What are you going to do with the rest of your... You're flying out tomorrow.
The day after. Yes, I'm doing a class at Manners this...
Today?
Yeah, in a couple of hours.
We got to get you out of here. Yeah, it's 2 o'clock now. You're going, that's at 4 or 5, right?
Yeah, 4, yeah.
Well, it's not that far. You just
take
the... No, I think
it'll be fine, yeah.
The G's right here.
Yeah.
L's right there.
Mm-hmm.
L goes there.
Mm-hmm. I don't know what you're saying, but yes.
Yeah. I'll explain it more.
Okay, cool.
Okay, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
That does it for my time with Laura Snowden. Great guitarist, bad interviewer. I don't often say that about myself. I mean, I mean it this time. But I don't know. I still haven't listened to the tracks. You see, the way this works is that I do an intro and outro, and then I listen and edit the show. You know, I can do it all in a coffee shop if I want. Sometimes I do. That's it. I'll see you next time with Randy Napoleon, jazz guitarist from old Detroit, Michigan.